from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The FDA is on the verge of ruling that meat and milk from cloned animals is as safe as regular meat and milk. But will ranchers and consumers show interest? Find out today on Insight. Also today, when you think of a front yard in a city, chances are a lawn and some flowers come to mind. What would you think if your neighbor was growing corn and other tall vegetables? Some gardeners in Sacramento want the city to remove restrictions from its code on what you can grow in your front yard. You'll hear the pros and cons. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, should you have the right to grow whatever you want in your front yard? That debate is going on in Sacramento. We'll hear the arguments. First, would you want to eat the meat or drink the milk of a cloned animal? These products aren't yet cleared for sale, but the Food and Drug Administration is moving toward doing just that. Late last month, the FDA released what it calls a draft risk assessment, finding, quote, that meat and milk from clones of adult cattle, pigs, and goats and their offspring are as safe to eat as food from conventionally bred animals, end of quote. It's one thing for scientists to conclude that cloned animals are identical to regular animals, but will consumers agree? We're going to take a closer look at this issue, including the science. We'll start with a dairy farmer from Turlock. He's Ray Souza. Ray, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
How do you feel about cloned cattle? Could you imagine adding cloned cows to your herd?
Well, I think the issue of cloned cattle, there are very, very few of them right now. As far as the idea of cloning as a technology, I think it's a natural progression. In the 50s, there was a lot of debate over artificial insemination. In the 60s, frozen semen became available. There was a lot of debate over that, and today it's an accepted practice. I think one of the most controversial technologies amongst dairy farmers today is the issue of sexed semen, where a farmer can actually select the sex of the offspring based on the semen that he uses on the mother cow. So this is just a natural progression, I think, because the technology is so new, there is some issues with consumer confidence.
Would you expect benefits to you as a dairy farmer if the meat and milk of cloned animals were allowed to be sold to consumers?
I think that cloned animals right now is almost a technology that's behind the times. In dairy cattle, we've been able to, through data collection, identify genetically superior animals. Most of our dairy cattle today are sired by bulls through artificial insemination. Those are bulls that have been tested. It takes about a five-year period to collect the data to identify these genetically superior animals. When you're cloning an animal, you're actually cloning today's genetics. As a dairy farmer, to progress, I want tomorrow's genetics. So we basically, I think that the cost is prohibitive. When we're talking between $25,000 and $30,000 for a cloned animal for today's genetics, I would sooner invest my money in tomorrow's genetics, trying to get the most up-to-date genetics possible.
If the byproducts of cloned animals are cleared for consumption, what do you think would be the benefit to consumers?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's going to be any real commercial availability of cloned animals. Again, the cost of cloning an animal today is between $25,000 and $30,000. The cost is so prohibitive that it's not a commercially viable thing to do for meat production or milk production. Where we've seen clones is primarily with a few individual animals, or primarily show animals, and they want to perpetuate those genetics for show purposes. But as a commercial meat or milk producing animal, I don't see that as commercially viable. So I'm not. It's not a big issue with me.
And is that the feeling of other dairy farmers that you know?
I talk to dairy farmers every day, and I have not heard one dairy farmer talk about the use of cloning as something they want to incorporate into their operation for commercial purposes.
Ray, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
That's Ray Souza. He's a dairy farmer in Turlock. Also with us by phone now is Michael Marsh, who's CEO of the Western United Dairymen. That's a dairy trade organization based in Modesto. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Jeffrey, nice to visit with you this afternoon.
How about the dairy industry in general? Is there a common position on this issue?
I think that the industry across the United States is going to approach this issue very cautiously. I think that we have to be aware, and we are very aware in the dairy industry in California, how responsive consumers are to changes in the food supply and how concerned consumers are, particularly here in California, about the perceived safety of their food supply. So I doubt very seriously that meat and milk from cloned animals will ever soon have widespread commercial acceptance in the United States, and clearly not in California.
Well, you probably heard Ray Souza. His reticence was to do with the cost of the process. You're saying that consumer acceptance might sink it.
I think it's probably going to be a combination of both, but I think that Ray's points were right on point. I can't imagine a dairy farmer who's struggling today to make ends meet investing that kind of money in an animal that by the time that the animal's born would be obsolete. So I rather doubt that it's going to really be that big an issue in the American food supply.
Of course, the cost of all technologies goes down over the years. Just because it's expensive today doesn't mean to say it would be expensive in the future. Do you think the attitude of dairy farmers would change if it became cheaper?
You know, I really don't think so, Jeffrey. And probably the biggest challenge that we've got out there is that you do have to have both. You have to have the commercial availability at a price that the farmer who's producing the milk and the meat can afford. And at the same time, you have to have consumer acceptance of the technology. And until you have the two combined, I don't think that it's going to occur. And as a matter of fact, our board here at West United Dairymen, I think, would be very reluctant to encourage our members to go ahead and invest in that type of technology until such time as consumer acceptance was widespread enough that it would not negatively impact their markets.
Michael Marsh with the Western United Dairymen. The FDA is on the verge of ruling that meat and milk from cloned animals is as safe as regular meat and milk. In our studio is an animal scientist at UC Davis. She's Alison Van Enenam. Specifically, she's an animal genomics and biotechnology extension specialist in the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis. Alison, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Jeffrey.
How much research has there been done into the safety of the meat and milk of cloned animals?
Well, the FDA report basically summarizes all the peer-reviewed research that's available into the milk and safety of the meat. And there haven't been that many clones produced in the world at this stage. And so the amount of research that's available really is somewhat limited by the number of animals that have been produced and have been extensively evaluated. However, the reports did find, of the animals that have been looked at, the meat and the milk was substantially equivalent to milk and meat from animals produced the old-fashioned way.
Would you consume the meat and milk of a cloned animal, assuming that you eat meat and milk?
The data does not suggest there's any difference between it. And in fact, one thing I want to make clear is we're talking now about this technology of cloning, which is somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning, which is a big way for talking about Dolly, right?
Yes.
I did want to make the point that for about 20 years, we've had other clones going into the food supply. That is, clones where the embryo has been split mechanically during the embryonic stage. And we've had genetically identical copies of cows that have been going into the food supply for about the last 20 years.
But didn't Dolly the sheep turn out rather poorly? Sure, her health was not good, and it was my understanding it was to do with the cloning process. Is that right?
Actually, Dolly, she lived to about the age of 7, which is not an unusual age for a sheep to die. And she was
prematurely old, wasn't she?
Well, there was some research done on the length of her chromosomes, and there was some reports that her telomeres were shorter. That is, she looked to be prematurely aging. Other studies have been done on other cloned animals and haven't found that result has been repeatable. She's an N of one, and so I think we need to look a little bit broader at the data that has been collected. And I think the risk assessment, the FDA, really has looked at all the data that's available. And adult clones appear to be healthy and normal and have no obvious differences in terms of their milk or meat composition that would give you any food safety concerns.
Do we know if cloned animals could create new toxins or allergens that regular animals don't have?
Well, clones, of course, are a genetic copy of an animal that's already in production. And it's really common convention that animal metabolites of the animals we eat commonly are not considered to be natural toxicants. They don't have venom or poisonous compounds in them that might be inadvertently turned on in a clone. And so it's not scientifically thought that it would actually create any novel compounds that would be in any way dangerous to eat.
Alison Van Inenem of UC Davis. On the phone is Will Rostov, who's a senior attorney at the Center for Food Safety. He's in San Francisco. That's a group opposed to, among other things, the consumption of meat and milk from cloned animals. Will, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Why do you think the FDA should not approve the meat and milk of cloned animals?
Well, there's several reasons. One, there's not enough evidence. As your last speaker just said, there's very few data points on this. In addition, there's really no benefit to consumers. There's no consumer acceptance. And they're also taking the wrong regulatory approach. Essentially, they're just doing a risk assessment and then saying the meat and milk is safe. But we think, and we've petitioned FDA to do this, that they should treat this as a new animal drug, where they'd have to do a much more rigorous testing procedure and produce a lot more evidence before they even considered this issue.
Are you opposed per se to the approval of the consumption of meat and milk from cloned animals? Or are you just opposed to the way that the FDA has handled it up until now?
Well, at this point, we're opposed to per se because there's not enough evidence. And we're also opposed to the way the FDA has handled it up to this point.
Allison, Will Rostov says that there's just not enough evidence to support the FDA's position. What's your response to that?
Well, they've looked at the data that is available, and there is no obvious difference between the meat and the milk at this time. And to look at it as a new animal drug would in some way be suggesting that there's some new genetics that's being introduced here, or some reason to expect that these animals are going to be unsafe to eat.
But aren't the stakes possibly quite high here? I mean, I guess we don't know if they are or not, but they're possibly quite high. Do you think that there's been enough evidence to confidently say that the meat and milk of cloned animals is okay and just the same as regular meat and milk?
Well, of course, it would always be nice to have more data, but at what stage do you say that you've got enough data? They've looked at all of the available evidence up to this time, and there's nothing coming out that appears to make them look any different to the genetically identical copies of the animals that they're coming from.
Will?
Well, first of all, only several hundred animals have been cloned, and these studies only have maybe 10, 15 animals in them. So data points are really small. And then there's been no long-term health studies. This is a very new technology. As you were discussing earlier, Dolly was the first animal to be cloned, and it did die at the age of 6 or 7. But the normal age for sheep is 11 or 12. I mean, there have been tremendous problems with cloning. And often when they try to clone an animal, a lot of the embryos die, a lot of the offspring die. So that there's a large percentage of animals that never make it and have a lot of health problems right at the start.
Will, in the press release that announced the FDA's current position on cloning, they quote the director of the FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine, Stephen Sundloff, and he says that this position was, quote, based on FDA's analysis of hundreds of peer-reviewed publications and other studies. That sounds like a lot to me.
If you actually look at the data, I mean, even your last speaker said there's based on the available data, and there's not that much data out there. If you look at other type of things, if they went through a new animal drug process that we're saying they need to do, they'd have to generate much more data, and they'd also have to do long-term health effect studies, neither one of which they have done yet. I mean, there's no reason to rush it to the market either. I mean, there's plenty of milk and meat in this system. Consumers don't want this, and there's actually no benefit to consumers. It's really only benefiting the biotech companies and the one or two, producers potentially who adopt it for efficiency reasons, but it's going to affect the dairy markets because some people aren't just going to buy milk if they don't know what's in their milk supply. I mean, the other thing the FDA is not doing is not labeling that these products are coming from cloned animals, and we think there needs to be a label if they're going to allow this.
Okay, Allison?
Well, I guess we have to look at food labeling laws in America, and basically we don't have a product-based labeling, or excuse me, you have product-based labeling, not process-based labeling. And what I mean by that is that the labels have to talk about the attributes of the product rather than how it was actually produced. And by law, FDA, if it's not different, which is what they've found in the studies that have done to date, can't put on there, this is produced by a clone, if it's not actually different, because that's what's called process-based labeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, Will?
Well, I think the American people are the ones who are going to suffer because they want to know what's in their food. They deserve a right to have their products labeled. But my first point, I think, is more important, that the FDA has just approached this totally wrong. They're just not using enough science, and they're not using the right regulatory approach.
Michael Marsh of the Western United Dairymen, as you probably heard, Will Rostov said that there's no reason to rush to market. Do you agree with that?
Well, listening to Will's comments, I have to probably disagree with most of what Will has said. But I think we have to have a science-based approach and not throw out the science, as I think that Will is suggesting. But at the same time, I think you, as I said earlier, I think we have to have consumer acceptance before the food industry, at the production level, starts getting into that.
Allison, I read a little while ago a sample letter to the editor that the group Will Rostov works for, the Center for Food Safety, sent out to its people. And here's a sentence from it. Scientists say that clones may be inherently unhealthy with potentially harmful consequences for animal foods derived from clones. What's your response to that?
Well, it's certainly true that neonatal clones have higher rates of mortality than traditionally derived offspring. However, the FDA looked at the case of animals that are going to be entering the food supply, and clones will be subjected to the same regulations as any other animal, and that is they have to be normal appearing and healthy before they will be allowed into the food supply. And so although it's true that at the moment there are problems with neonatal calves and quite high losses, those animals would not be going into the food supply. The milk and the meat from clones are going to be coming from normally appearing healthy animals that were cloned, and that's what the FDA is based its safety assessment on, and in those situations they haven't found any difference between the milk and meat from clones and regularly produced animals.
Will, do you want to defend the sentence in the letter?
Yeah, I mean, she's saying, I mean, we agree with the science she's describing, but she's saying normally appearing animals. The studies haven't gone through the life cycle of these animals and then look at the long-term health effects of these animals on people, eating them over a long period of time. There's just simply not enough evidence. It's not the right time to be making these decisions. And a risk assessment is not the appropriate vehicle for doing this decision.
Will, how do you know that consumers care about this?
Well, the Pew Foundation has done surveys about this. And their surveys find that 66% of the people are uncomfortable with cloned animals. I mean, I know for me personally, I would not want to eat something that's not natural.
Yeah, but of course, the cloned meat and milk is not currently on the market. And if you ask people what they think about something that isn't really in their face, then, you know, it's not surprising, perhaps, that they would be at least underwhelmed, maybe even opposed to it. Are you confident that when cloned meat and milk comes to market, if it does, that consumers will actually still be opposed to it?
Yeah, I mean, because what's it really getting anybody? All it's doing is potentially creating a more efficient dairy cow or more, you know, a bigger cow. But as your first speaker said, it's an old it's not even a good technology for the current industry. So there's really just no reason to be doing it.
Our final guest on this topic is Christine Brune. She researches consumer issues in food quality and safety. She works at the UC Davis Food Science and Technology Department as a specialist in the Cooperative Extension. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
What do you think consumers, is there any way to know or to predict how consumers would respond to the meat and milk of cloned animals?
Indeed, surveys have shown that consumers are uncomfortable with the term cloned, but when you do a survey, you raise level of discomfort just by asking a question. I think that it's very easy to get an apparent resistance to something by throwing out technical terms to the public. Indeed, when people hear that the FDA has evaluated this and approved its safety, then the number of individuals ready to buy, indicating they will buy and consume the products, increases significantly, depending again, once more, on what words are used. So most people at this stage don't know a lot about biotechnology, don't know a lot about cloning, and are apprehensive. But when they hear something is identical to what they've been eating all along, most are comfortable with it.
What about other technological innovations in food when they've been rolled out? Are there any examples from that might help us guess how consumers will respond if and when cloned meat and milk really does reach the shelves?
Gee, just about everything. When you throw the term technology in there, you have an initial hesitancy. Often consumers don't hear how something is produced. I was interested to hear Will comment that he's uncomfortable eating anything that's not natural, but I wonder how many people realize that reproduction takes place in the animal world, and the meat and dairy, at least, primarily by artificial insemination. So it's just it's a term. It's a safe method of raising animals. And indeed, twins that might come from this process are safe animals. But if you start talking about how the process is done, you might have people responding to the word artificial and forgetting that the fact is they're getting an animal that looks and acts and produces normally.
Do you think, Christine, that the products of cloned animals should be labeled specifically as the product of a cloned animal?
Well, actually, I support the FDA's approach. I think FDA has done exactly what the public expects them to do, and that they've evaluated the science here. And looking at the chemical analysis of meat and milk, the nutrition from these products, they find no difference. And they have the expertise to evaluate the studies and to make these decisions, and they've conveyed that to the public.
Yeah.
So the public has indicated in attitude surveys that they expect to make and are supportive of FDA's decision that looks and does not mandate labeling unless there's a nutritional or an allergy or a safety difference.
Okay, we have just time for a quick final comments from each of you. And Will, since you're outnumbered, I'll give you the last word. Let's start with Michael Marsh.
Well, once again, I think that as Ray Souza indicated, the dairy producer from down in Turlock, the technology is going to be extremely costly for anyone to even consider implementing. And at the same time, it's not going to be timely by the time that the livestock is ready for market or the milk might be ready for market. I doubt very much that it's going to be widespread.
Okay.
And at the same time, our position is going to be we need to have consumers accepting it before we would encourage using the technology.
Allison?
Yeah, I guess I'll follow up on that. Just given the cost, most of the animals that are cloned are going to be in the upper echelon of the breeding pyramid. And so what will actually be on the market are going to be progeny of clones, that is, progeny derived from maybe a semen straw, derived from a clone bull, potentially, that's a very valuable animal. And the data on those animals also shows that there's no difference between them and normally produced animals.
Christine?
I think it's advantageous to the public to continue to look at new ways to increase quality and safety. And as an educator, I'm hoping that we can all work together to let the public understand what their choices are.
And finally, Will Rostov?
Yeah, once again, there's not enough evidence to be making this decision. And even if the FDA is making this decision, they should give the consumers a right to choose. There should be an opportunity for labeling.
Okay.
And until then, we think this is a bad technology that shouldn't come to market.
Well, thank you all very much. This issue is obviously still to be resolved. Thanks to our guest in the studio, Allison van Inenam of UC Davis, the Department of Animal Science, and on the phone, Christine Bruhn of the U.S. UC Davis Food Science and Technology Department, Will Rostov at the Center for Food Safety, and Michael Marsh of the Western United Dairymen, and earlier Ray Souza, dairy farmer from Turlock. Thank you all.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, should you have the right to grow whatever you want in your front yard? That debate is going on in Sacramento. The arguments when we come back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight anytime you like. Subscribe to the Insight podcast at capradio.org/insight. Look for the little orange box with the word pod. When you think of a front yard in a city, chances are a lawn and some flowers come to mind. So what would you think if your neighbor started growing corn and other tall vegetables? Some gardeners in Sacramento want the city to remove restrictions from its code on what you can grow in your front yard. The city seems interested in loosening things up a bit, but not to the extent, at least not yet, that the gardener activists would like. Let's find out what's going on. We'll start with Kim Glazard. She's Executive Director of Organic Sacramento and co-chair of a group founded to push for removing front yard restrictions. It's called Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes. Kim, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
I understand that this issue came to the fore a couple of years ago because of the front yard of a woman called Karen Bauman in East Sacramento. She's out of the country, so she wasn't available to join us today. But could you tell us about Karen's front yard and what happened?
Well, basically, she had grown diverse landscape, a combination of fruits and vegetables and herbs and other annuals and perennials in her front yard. And different varying sizes and patterns within the front yard area. And she was given a citation by the city. Apparently, somebody had complained about the look of the yard and given a citation by the city code enforcement, which was pretty outrageous. It was an $800 fine. And she was asked to pay that remove her garden and remove the vegetables and plants out of her front yard or pay the fine.
Did she do that?
She eventually, actually, this came to a head very quickly, and there was a lot of community response. And the city council received many, many phone calls, I think up to 70 or 80, and they actually retracted the fine and allowed her to continue to maintain her garden. And what happened was that then it became an issue where the whole concept around what the current landscape ordinance was became a question mark. What are we going to do with that ordinance? Is it going to remain? Are we going to make changes? And it went into a whole process of what the changes needed to be to bring it up to current standards that would work for our society now.
Before we go into what those changes might be, we'll talk with Ron O'Connor, who's the manager of the City of Sacramento's Department of Code Enforcement. He enforces the city's landscaping code. Ron, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Good afternoon.
What does the city code allow you to do in your front yard, and what are you not allowed to do?
Well, the code requires that you have low-growing vegetation, so close to the ground. It all has to be vegetation. It's pretty much designed for lawns and some shrubbery around.
Does it specify what vegetation you can or can't grow?
No, it doesn't at this time, just low-growing.
And what does low-growing mean? How is that interpreted?
It is interpreted to, well, most things are not allowed according to low-growing, which would include rose bushes and things like that if they get very high. So it's that needs to be reworked.
So the code doesn't actually say how high a plant can be. It just says they need to be low growing.
Correct.
So how do you, if you're driving around, what's your rule of thumb when you see a plant?
Well, first of all, we're not driving around looking for them. We work off of complaints. But if we do have a complaint, pretty much we try to make sure that it's maintained and it's, you know, not, you know, it's a judgment call across the board. And most plants, if it's a shrub, try to keep it under the windows. And if it's a lawn that has to be mowed, you know, it's
okay.
It's a little difficult sometimes to judge.
Okay. In our studio is Sue Jennings, who's, along with Kim Glazard, co-chair of Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How would you like to see the city's code changed when it comes to front yard landscapes?
Well, actually, code enforcement has been working with us, and they have proposed a change to the code, and we really do support what they're proposing, except for one area, and that one area is restricting fruits and vegetables. It's restricting the growing of food to right now. This came out of the Law and Legislative Committee of the City Council.
The City Council, yeah.
Mm-hmm, to 30% of the front yard landscape area, which is actually that you can grow in, which is actually 60% of the front yard you can grow in, supposedly the lawn and ground cover. But now they're saying that you can grow fruits, you can grow shrubs, annuals, perennials, except for they're restricting the fruits and vegetables to 30% and with a height limit of 4 feet, except for fruit trees. You can grow fruit trees.
So, Ron, the shrubs, do they have to be low-growing?
No,
they
don't.
This were passed.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you, Ron. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, the shrubs do not have to be low-growing. They have to be maintained. The only restriction for shrubs in height is in the two safety zones, depending if you're on a corner house or on a regular street without a corner. And then everything has to be no higher than 4 feet, except for trees, and they would have to be trimmed from 5 feet down so you have a view area coming out of your driveway.
Why is it okay to grow shrubs, higher than the traditional low-growing vegetation, but the fruit and vegetables need to be restricted to 30% of the cultivatable area, if that's the correct word?
That's the direction that we got to the main item that was discussed, and the direction we were given was to keep the height of the vegetables down.
And this direction came from?
In the Law and Legislation Committee meeting.
Okay. Well, a member of the Law and Legislation Committee is with us in our studio. He's Steve Cohn, Sacramento City Councilman, representing District 3, which includes East Sacramento, which is, one of the epicenters of this issue. Steve, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, you support liberalizing the code on this matter.
I do.
Why?
Well, I feel it makes no sense to discriminate against edible landscaping. The issue that we're grappling with is a code enforcement nuisance or health and safety issue, and there are plenty of regulations that already apply in that regard. So to me, I don't see the need to single out fruits and vegetables for additional regulation. If the issue is that someone's not taking care of their landscaping or that it's a nuisance, et cetera, we should just directly look at that rather than whether or not the landscaping is edible or inedible.
Now, you serve on the Law and Legislation Committee.
I do.
Which I guess is the policy review body for the City Council.
There are 4 members of the council out of the total of 9.
And Robbie Waters and Sandy Sheedy also serve in the committee.
Right, and Lauren Hammond as well.
We tried to get Robbie Waters and Sandy Sheedy to participate in today's program, but they weren't available. Could you summarize for us, Steve Cohn, the discussion, and briefly summarize the discussion, how the Law and Legislation Committee decided that 30% could go to fruit and veg, but the shrubs could no longer had to be low-growing?
Well, I think the 30% was, frankly, an arbitrary compromise just to say here's some portion of the lawn you can grow fruits and vegetables. I think the issue that the folks on the council who want to maintain a more restrictive regulation, what they're concerned about are neighborhoods, particularly where you have homes and lawns that are not well kept, where it could create a nuisance and drag down the property values. I think, frankly, you're dealing with a bit of a culture clash. I think what's happened is we have an old regulation that was designed during a time when everyone just accepted that a lawn was the style that everyone should have. And now we're at a time when we realize that we have other goals here, sustainability among them, that are very important in addition to code enforcement and prohibiting nuisances. And we need to have a better compromise or between those different goals.
What happens next in this process?
It'll go to the full council. And frankly, I'm pretty optimistic that the full council will be more supportive of the Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes. I have no guarantee of that because under the Brown Act, I can't really talk directly with more than three other council members. But I would hope, though, that we'll have a better shot there than we did at the law and legislation.
When do you think the council will consider this?
I expect it sometime in the next 2 months. Ron O'Connor might know when it's actually scheduled, but I believe it'll be sometime in the next 2 months.
Well, let's go to Ron.
It's not scheduled for council at this time. We have it scheduled for the Law and Legislation Committee. I'm trying to find that now on my computer.
The Planning Commission.
Planning Commission. Thank you.
That's on the
January 11th. Okay.
So then,
I have January 25th down, or January 11th, yes.
It'll probably come to council then within a month or so after Planning Commission.
Okay. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more on front yard restrictions. Should you be allowed to grow what you want in a city front yard? What belongs in a city front yard? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Should you have the right to grow whatever you want in your front yard? That debate is going on in Sacramento, where there are currently rather tight restrictions on the growing of vegetables and fruit in front yards. Some gardeners want those restrictions removed. The city seems interested in some change, but not yet to anything like the extent that the gardeners favor. One of our guests you've already met, Kim Glazard, is on the phone. She's the co-chair of Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes. Kim, do you think there are any plant species that do not belong in a front yard?
At this point, I don't think that really is the question, no. I think that, I know that there is a big concern about corn stalks. That really was one of the issues that was raised by the Law and Ledge, members of the Law and Ledge Committee. And then if that is really what's driving them, then maybe that's where they need to put their efforts in banning corn stalks in the front yard. I don't personally agree that that's an issue. One of the things that I think people are forgetting is, number one, that diverse, well, especially gardens in diverse landscapes, they're transitional. And they're, maybe corn stalks are going to be there for a month or 2 months at the most, because gardens are constantly changing with the seasons. The other factor is that most people who are going to be planting maybe 100% of their yard and garden, they're going to be gardeners that long-term gardeners that are really committed to gardening, and they're going to be putting quality effort into their work. I mean, most people are not going to try to tear up their grass and make things, you know, more difficult if they. More difficult for themselves.
But I think there are a lot of trashy gardens, even with the current restrictions.
Well, there are, but people who are going to have trashy gardens or trashy are going to have trashy lawns as well. You know, you're not going to have somebody who is going to upkeep their lawn, but then not upkeep their garden. It's not, you know, you're going to have one or the other. And as Councilmember Cohn said, there already are rules and restrictions on the books that can cover these sort of issues.
In our studio is Dave Roberts. He's the owner of Roberts Landscape. He's a member of Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes, and he is an ecological landscaper, I think would be a fair description. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
What do you think about appropriate species for, I mean, obviously you support liberalizing the code in Sacramento, but do you as a landscaper envision any species of plants that you would go, no, you should not put that in your front yard?
Well, first of all, there's been a growing trend toward more natural landscapes, even when there's still turf involved. And one of the things, if we really want to get down on plants, there are invasive species that have actually escaped into our watersheds, into our native areas, and created a lot of havoc. Just for a quick example is Scotch broom is a very severe problem throughout the state of California. Pampas grass that people love has nearly taken over portions of the coast. So, yes, there are plants we would like to see eliminated. But in general, the flexibility to have yards that are beyond what I consider conventional, and that's the lawn and bushes sort of scenario, are a growing trend, and we need codes that will allow us those kind of plantings.
Steve Cohn, are you concerned at all that that people who currently have a trashy lawn could have trashy corn stalks? And Kim said, you know, it might be the same person that will do this, but there'll be a much bigger visual impact of the front yard that was not well maintained with corn stalks and other large plants there as opposed to a lawn.
Well, there's always a concern when you're talking about nuisance. And generally, you are dealing more with the exception rather than the rules. But unfortunately, the rule applies to everybody. And I think what we have is a rule that attempts to fit a square peg into a round hole. We really ought to address the issue of upkeep, whether it is vegetation that's edible or not, and not draw this arbitrary distinction between whether or not the vegetation's edible. I mean, someone can also have a very ugly-looking bush as well as something that has a living fruit or vegetable on it.
Let's bring one other person into the conversation. Lana Saray is a journeyman composter and amateur gardener who lives in the Arden Arcade neighborhood in Sacramento County, not in the city, we should note. Lana, welcome to the program.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. There was an interference.
Oh, I was just welcoming you to the program.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and I feel in good company. And hello, everyone. It's a lovely afternoon.
Well, Lana, what would you support? What do you think makes sense for maintaining a sustainable, attractive, respectable front yard?
Well, you've hit it. First of all, I'm glad to hear that there are code restrictions against people having trashy lawns, regardless of what they're growing. I didn't know that, and I'm glad to hear that. And I think just the culture shock going from the water hog sod lawns that we're all used to suddenly abundant fruits and vegetables could be mitigated by something like, let's say, 50% food and 50% native grasses, plants, and herbs. I have started in my own yard with some native grasses, bunch grasses, and they provide a lot of winter interest so that if people were actually growing corn and other fruits that and vegetables that, you know, look pretty awful if they're left during the winter, they could at least have something beautiful like an area of bunch grasses or some perennials along with the food. So I like to see a gradient approach to combining food growing and other types of plants. Especially, I just discovered a type of grass that you can either mow or not mow, but it's very low water usage and it's beautiful. It's as beautiful as other as the regular rylons that we're used to.
Sue Jennings, why do people want to grow vegetables and corn and so on in the front yard, why not just leave that at the back of the house where no one can see it, and then you got all these nice, easy to maintain front yards that all look the same?
Well, I've been growing vegetables in my backyard because I have sun in my backyard. But Sacramento is number two to Paris for being the city of trees. And we have a huge tree canopy, and many people do not have sun in their backyard. They don't have the option. That's why Karen Bauman had her sons growing tomatoes in the front yard in the Junior Master Gardener program, because she had no sun in the backyard. And that's what started this whole thing. But in listening to what the last lady said about the front yards, I'm an organic gardener, and one of the things we talk a lot about is interspersing different species. And that's why, as a group, we're saying we really want to support diverse landscapes, planting the edibles and the non, and because this is better for pest control and a lot of other things.
Steve Cohn, the city of Sacramento is working towards a plan for sustainable gardening citywide. Is that right?
Right.
Is this part of that overall process, or is this a separate issue?
Well, it's been a separate issue, but to me, they are linked. And here, on the one hand, we have a very strong demand for folks to have land for gardening, and some folks don't have land of their own, so they need the community gardens. Other people own their land or rent and have the room to do it on their own. Now, if someone tried to make commercial use of their front yard, that's a totally different question than what we're dealing with here. And let me just assure our listeners that irrespective of the particular provision that the Citizens for Sustainable Landscape have a problem with, as I mentioned, if that were taken out as they propose, that doesn't mean that somebody can just grow a messy garden. The language of the existing and other proposed rules would require maintaining landscaping in a neat and orderly fashion. So It is subjective, but even as you heard from Ron, the existing rules are even more subjective.
Dave Roberts, with the code as it is right now, if someone wants to push the envelope a little bit and do a little bit of vegetable cultivation in their front yard, is there anything they can do right now that you've advised people to do or help people do?
Well, we've been helping people put in more of the herbs and sort of less obnoxious types of vegetables, at least in the opinion of some people, things that obviously don't grow real tall, like corn and so forth. But I've actually had clients who have been coming to me for edible gardens. We design them and install them for them. And, they're a bit anxious about this because they want the flexibility to be able to put in what they would like.
Ron O'Connor, are you and your and the others in the code department looking forward to a change in the code, an updating of it?
We're looking forward to a code that's enforceable and that is not as subjective as the one is now. And the one we designed is actually, it's a compromise between, the traditional landscaping, which, a lot of people prefer. I mean, I'd guess that you would see more gardens if people wanted them. But it's a compromise between that and the traditional, traditional landscaping and the gardening. And it is a huge relaxation of the rules that were previously enforced. But yes, I would like to see something that to change this ordinance.
We're just going to have to quickly wrap up here. Kim Glazard, final thoughts from you?
Well, one thing is that there is only going to be, at least initially, a small number of people that are even going to want to do this. I can't even imagine more than a couple dozen citywide, because it's not necessarily a popular thing at this point. But I do think that we need to bring the code not only up to the present, but we need to project it out into the future, because the last code lasted 50 years. And if we're going out 50 years, we have to consider where our world is going to be at that point. And we have to consider sustainability issues, which the city itself is already beginning to embrace, as was mentioned earlier. However, this is part of that, and also food security and hunger issues and those kinds of things that edible landscapes would help to address. are really, really important.
And finally, Lana Saray, what kind of vegetable would you like to see more of in front yards?
How about squash? They have beautiful leaves and flowers that you can put in minestrone soup. I was joking, but they are a beautiful plant, and I'd like to see anything that people would actually eat and benefit from.
Well, thank you all very much. On the phone, Lana Saray, who you just heard, she lives in Arden Arcade in Sacramento County, and Kim Glazart of Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes, and Ron O'Connor, manager of the City of Sacramento Department of Code Enforcement, and in our studio, Sacramento City Councilman Steve Cohn. I've got so many people here. Dave Roberts, owner of Roberts Landscape, and Sue Jennings, also of Sacramento Citizens for Sustainable Landscapes. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Almost from day one, Insight has attracted the smartest interns you can imagine. Help us maintain that tradition by applying to join our team. Info at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the challenge for peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. That and the rest of the day's news on the world. Insight staff includes Mark Jones, Natalie Breen, Jen Picard, and Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. Egg enthusiasts. There are two vacancies on California's Shell Egg Advisory Committee. You'll hear what the committee does and how one qualifies to be a member. Also, one man from our region tells you about the unique and varied ways his nonprofit makes a difference for people in Afghanistan. And another tells you how to deal with conflicts that arise over your kids' homework. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join us for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.